Welcome to Standards of Justice. This podcast is proudly brought to you by AllRise. We've all heard the expression, people don't change. It's usually offered up as a justification for cutting someone loose from your life after they've repeatedly let you down. But anyone working in treatment court knows this isn't necessarily true. In fact, the entire reason for treatment court is rooted in the belief that people can and do change. The process isn't easy. It takes time. It's full of setbacks and frustrations, and it demands patience from everyone involved. But it's also one of the most rewarding aspects of this work, participating in someone rewriting their story and rebuilding their life. The process of change becomes more complicated when we think of the population treatment courts are intended to serve. From the first adult treatment court standard on target population, we understand we are serving folks with long histories of substance use, many with significant mental health needs and histories of trauma. These are individuals with potentially years of chaos and instability in their lives, difficult family dynamics, financial and housing instability, healthcare needs, and more. And yet, in treatment courts, we dedicate ourselves to bringing about lasting change. Today, we'll talk about how we do it. On the show, we're diving into Adult Treatment Court Best Practice Standard 4, Incentives, Sanctions, and Service Adjustments. This standard is the blueprint for how treatment courts encourage progress, address setbacks, and provide the right support at the right time. It's not just about rules or punishments. It's about creating an environment where transformation can truly thrive. With us today is Judge Charles Auslander, who has served as a state court judge in Athens, Clark County, Georgia since 2011, the same year he began presiding over an impaired driving treatment court. Under his leadership, the Athens, Clark County DUI court was recognized as a National Academy court, and Judge Auslander serves as faculty for AllRise and trains on a variety of topics, including the one we'll be discussing today. So, let's have a conversation with Judge Charles Auslander about Standard 4, Incentives, Sanctions, and Service Adjustments. You know, what I do, I sit down, I start thinking about the episode, okay, who are we going to talk to, and I start putting some feelers out there, and usually pretty quickly, one or two names bubble to the top, and when I was asking around about this standard, your name just kept coming up, and they said, you got to talk to Judge Auslander. He's awesome on this, and he's out there, does, you know, not only in his own courtroom, but out there training, and so I really appreciate you being willing to spend a little time to help us understand, a really tricky standard, and a standard that has changed somewhat from the first edition to the second edition. So thanks for doing that.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me to this discussion.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always like to get a little bit of background, and I wonder if you could just talk through how you came to preside over treatment court. And really, I always love hearing, particularly from judges, what that experience was like, kind of juxtaposing work in the justice system before treatment courts, and then discovering this model and all that it does, and how that maybe changed your own perspective of the work you do.
Well, that's an interesting question. I started out as a criminal defense attorney, and so I was in the courts a lot representing people. And the first time I ever learned about an impaired driving court or a drug court was when I was representing a guy, I'm just going to call him Mr. B. Mm-hmm. And I represented him in several impaired driving cases. And I went to court and I learned that Judge Kent Lawrence here in Clark County had just started an impaired driving court. They called it a drug court back then. And I'd never heard of one. And it was one of the first ones in the state of Georgia and nationally. And so Mr. B was just a client. I loved him. He was an older gentleman. But when he came to court, he smelled like he'd been drinking the night before, and he was never successful on probation. And when they started explaining to us the requirements of the DUI court, we counseled about it, and we just decided it was just too tough for him. Mm-hmm. And so we just thought there was no way that he was going to be successful. And so he ended up pleading out and going to jail for a significant time. So this was around the end of 2001. And in 2002, I became a magistrate judge here and went on with my judicial career, just in the same mindset. Well, about 2005, Judge Kent Lawrence actually came to me and said he needed some assistance to have an assisting judge with him in the court. And so I said, well, let me come and view your court and visit it and see about your court. And when I walked into the status hearing, the court review, in the front row was Mr. B. This is 5 years or 4 or 5 years later. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, I heard how amazing he was doing, how successful he was. It immediately made me realize that I had done a great disservice to him 4 years earlier by recommending him away from the court. Mm-hmm. I did a disservice to the community because ultimately he got another DUI. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, he had an attorney at that time who knew what a DUI court was and could refer him into it. And since then, he's never been back in the court system. And that immediately sold me that I had to better understand DUI courts. I mean, so right away from day one, I was sold. I joined the team as an assisting judge in 2011. Judge Lawrence retired, and ultimately I took over as presiding judge of the DUI court here in Clark County.
I love that story so much because, you know, it's never too late to have our notions of justice and what works and what doesn't, and the ability of people to change, challenge. And you know, this standard is all about that idea of, you know, change. I talk in the intro about, you know, sometimes we hear, well, people don't change. And, you know, it's sort of a comment that's thrown out there usually to justify, you know, cutting someone out of your life who's causing you some sort of distress. But the truth of it is people can and do change. It is not easy. It requires significant time and attention and patience and missteps along the way. But if there's one thing we know from working in treatment courts, it's that people can and do change. And so that's a great story. And I had the opportunity to meet Judge Lawrence on several occasions in sort of my early days here with All Rise, and what a hero to this treatment court movement he was. Any opportunity to honor the legacy of someone like that, I think we should take. So I'm glad you brought him up. Well, you know, I think of this standard, all of the standards, you know, have themes running through them, and treatment courts in general have a theme of collaboration. This is a really interesting standard because of the way it combines so much of what the standards talk about in relation to treatment and recovery, and then the justice side and how the justice system is responding to behavior. And, you know, for the first edition of this standard, which came out over a decade ago, it was incentives and sanctions. And now we have reframed the standard, and it includes this term service adjustments. And I just wonder, before we kind of get into the gritty details, you know, how do you characterize this change? What does it tell us about this evolving approach to the way we're viewing participant behavior, the fact that we now include service adjustments along with incentives and sanctions?
One thing I appreciate the way that you refer to it as evolving. Mm-hmm. For us to improve, we always have to realize that we're not at our end goal. We're always improving. So I really like that term you use, evolving. And I fully agree with you. We've seen from, you know, when these were first released more than 10 years ago, like you said, incentives and sanctions. And I think we as treatment court professionals have gained a better understandings that our clients are afflicted with medically diagnosed disorders that affect their ability to make rational decisions, mm-hmm. and that it's not a moral failing that should be punished. So I think we better understand the medical model and that it addresses these disorders more effectively and helps clients heal. And I really like what you said, and I believe Judge Nettow also said this when you talked with her, is that we have to be more patient mm-hmm. than the disorder. And so I think what we've done over the past 10 or 12 years, at least I have and my team has, is that while our treatment providers have always understood this, we on the court side, and you talk about collaboration, we on the court side have gained a better understanding of the role of treatment effective case management and peer support in helping clients change their behavior. So I think it's actually been us on the court side of that have been learning what our treatment professionals, our case managers have always known. And that's helped us to better understand the tools and strategies we have and the appropriate time to apply them. And so to me, this is a perfect evolution of our knowledge on the court side.
And in some ways, it gives permission for us, for treatment courts, to accept that that evolution plays out in changes to policy and procedures and, challenging some of the way we've done things in the past and being willing to accept that, you know, the time maybe is here to change those things. And that's okay. That's part of the process as we get new research and new insight into all of these elements of treatment court. It's sort of a never-ending process of evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I first joined the team, it was really anytime we had a behavior, the response is, what is probation going to say we're going to do? Is it going to be community service? Is it going to be jail? And our focus in the conversations were on that. But as we gain confidence and trust in our treatment providers and they gain more of a voice at the table, we began to understand that those weren't the discussions we should be having. We should actually be looking at what was causing the underlying behavior. And then once we gain confidence in that, we could repeat it and we could repeat it and we could see better progress. And then treatment felt more confident. I'm sure we've all been at a table where treatment is afraid to speak because this isn't their environment naturally. And when we can finally make it safe for them to be able to speak, then we can all learn and benefit.
Well, I want to return to that in a little bit because I want to hear your perspective, particularly as a judge, on how some of those conversations play out when it comes to decision making around responding to behavior. So I'm so glad you mentioned that. One of the real exciting and challenging developments that is included in this second edition of this standard is the research and guidance on proximal, distal, and managed goals. And I check in with our training folks pretty frequently, and I keep hearing that this is a really tricky concept, and we're still in the process of kind of figuring out how to talk about it in a way that folks understand and can really use and apply. So I think that's a good place to dig into the weeds here. Can you help us understand what the standards mean when they talk about proximal, distal, and managed goals?
Well, just starting with proximal, it's something that the client can do now. Mm-hmm. And not just do now, but actually can repeat and consistently do. So yes, maybe a client can stay abstinent for a day, but if they can't repeat that for a number of days in a row, then that's not a proximal behavior. So things that we initially think of as proximal are just attending, mm-hmm. Whatever their requirements are, being truthful. Now, truth may be difficult, but there should not be a reason a person can't be truthful. And then just participating in counseling, being present and actually engaging in the counseling and whatever they're asking you to be present. It doesn't mean you're having to get benefits or you're buying in or you're developing an alliance yet, but it's that you're actually there and you're listening and you're responding when you're asked to respond. So, I mean, those are things that we expect our clients can do right away and should be able to repeat. Now, if one of our clients has a problem with one of that, then it might not be a proximal goal. And so these are things that all of our clients should be able to do. So we want to, give them positive reinforcement for everything they're doing, but the rewards are low. Mm-hmm. And if they don't do it, we want to take that serious. If they're not showing up to counseling, if they're being blatantly dishonest, we want to take that seriously and make sure our clients understand that that's not acceptable because we expect that they can do that. Distal. These are the behaviors that really are bringing the clients into our programs. I mean, if all of our clients had behaviors that were proximal and goals that were proximal, we wouldn't need treatment courts.
Right.
But distal, that's really what we're here to serve. And so distals are those goals that are just not yet either achievable. So maybe a person, if we're going to talk about absence, who just is in constant use and hasn't withdrawn yet, they can't even achieve a day of abstinence. Or it's something that can't be consistently repeated. So they may be in brief abstinence, but there's always that worry or fear because of cravings or anhedonia or other things that they may lapse right back into use if they're in the wrong setting. So distal goals would be things like abstinence. It could potentially be housing stability if they're not connected to the right resources. It depends, or it could just be job stability. Some of our participants and clients just aren't at a position where they can even take a job or be reliable enough to be a job. So when we can get someone in our program, these are what we want to address, because they're the much more difficult, repeatable goals. And these are the ones that, you know, when a person can't meet these goals, that's where our service adjustments come in. Right. That's where treatment comes in. Our clinicians, our peer support, our supervision, providing those interventions that are going to help people be able to attain that.
Well, I love, and I think the standards say this rather explicitly, but that idea that the sort of the service adjustments are there to help move the people, move goals from being distal to proximal. These are newish terms to a lot of people. And so it's taking time to learn them, but the way you broke it down is so helpful, and it makes so much sense that understanding this distinction between what is achievable or expected to be achievable in the short term versus what's more of a long-term, initially likely unachievable goal, it makes total sense that that would a grounding and understanding of that is so necessary to figuring out how to respond to behavior. Right. Unless we have a clear, really clear understanding of what these goals are. And I assume, and I'd love to ask you about, you know, that's both the participant and the team being on the same page with what these goals are, you know, in the absence of that, those conversations and that understanding, it makes behavior modification extremely difficult, because you might end up punishing behavior that the person basically doesn't have much control over. How do courts identify these goals, and is there a process in which they're having those conversations with the participant to try to help them understand what is expected of them proximally versus distal?
You are dead on with that. If we don't clarify and make very clear to our participants what our expectations are, and then utilize the tools we have, the assessments, the knowledge of the counselors or clinicians or peer support or supervision to determine whether this is actually an achievable and repeatable goal, we're not going to have any success. So first, I agree with you. They have to understand very clearly what the expectations are. And if they are not able to meet them, that's the conversation that we have, is you were not able to meet this goal. We recognize it is a very difficult goal. It's hard to achieve. And here is what we are going to put in place to support or help you or try to get you to that point. We know you can get there. We just understand you don't have everything you need right now to do that. And to me, that's why service adjustments, I really like the term, because service adjustments is more than just saying treatment. Mm-hmm. We know that treatment is a part of service adjustments. And so, you know, if somebody's struggling, it can be something as simple as increasing the level of care, dosage, or frequency. But there's so many other pieces to it. It could be supports for social services, just getting that reliable transportation or that stable housing or getting that medical care, or just the time management skill that they don't have, or the peer support, or it could be even just that accountability piece in addition to that from supervision that they're checking in daily, or maybe mm-hmm. they're testing an extra day or two a week, or they're having a monitoring device to help them test, just to be that additional piece of support. So service adjustments are really across all of the professions that we have that are trained to help us with behavior change. I'll give you one quick example.
Yeah.
Had a woman in our court few months ago. She has four children. She was currently separated from her children. They were living with her mom. She wasn't living with her mom, and she was just distraught and could not stop using. And we had her in court, and she was giving up. She just said, I'm done. She was telling us all of the challenges, struggles. I mean, all of us could feel the weight on her shoulders. I mean, you've been there. You've heard that. And one of the things she told us that we did not know is that her mental health medication prescription had run out and she didn't have the money to get her medication. So immediately our case manager got on the phone with our local clinic, got her an appointment the next day, and got her to back to where she could have her medication. Well, just getting her back on her medication, which to me is a service adjustment.
Yep.
Getting her connected with her doctor again was enough to help get her over that threshold to not give up, to get back in the game. And for the past 2 months, we're only 2 months in.
Yep.
Been able to maintain sobriety. She's got a new lease on life. She's ready to go back there. And it was just something that we needed to address, that we could address versus punish.
Well, and I like that example. In almost every conversation we have around the standards for this podcast, there are these sort of underlying themes, one of which is trust. And we talked a lot with Julie Seitz around Standard 5 and 6 about establishing and building this foundation of trust. And I would think, I think the story you just told indicates that, you know, imagine what that did for her in terms of her ability to sort of trust the program and the way in which you all responded quickly to help her. But just that idea of goal setting collaboratively with participants seems to me something that can really establish a foundation of trust that's going to be so beneficial down the road when there's some sort of hiccup or bump along the way. I wonder if there's some discomfort out there among treatment court professionals when it comes to accepting that abstinence is a distal goal at first. And I wonder if there's some discomfort with, well, if I let them know that, you know, we're not expecting abstinence right off the bat, I'm giving them kind of permission. Do you ever hear that? And how do we help folks overcome that concern?
I think you've hit one of the real difficulties for people in the legal profession and judges when they're trying to understand this. Mm-hmm. And what you have articulated is something that I run into again and again and again when I go out and train with teams. There's a belief that is misguided from us in the justice system that we can't allow certain behaviors. And if they happen, we have to punish them. And for some reason, a lot of times jail is our response that we think it's going to send the appropriate message. Mm-hmm. But as we know, it actually does the opposite thing. As you mentioned, we have to be able to build that trust, that therapeutic alliance with the client. And so we have to give them the opportunity. We don't ask them to, but we have to give them the opportunity to fail, be honest about it, be able to assess their conduct in an open way so they can actually seek to make changes versus hiding that conduct or being fearful. And it is hard to explain to these teams that, yes, you have to be prepared to allow people to come in with positive screens and you're not going to respond with sanctions, that you have to have that patience, more patients than the disease, because they feel like they have to, like for some reason we're magical here in the courts. And if we just respond in a particular way, we're going to solve problems. But as you stated at the beginning, it's not about that. It takes time. It takes healing. You have to develop that therapeutic line. So I run into this again and again. When we ultimately made the shift, it took a long time to kind of convince all of our team that yes, positive screens, we're not going to sanction. We're going to let treatment begin to work. We're going to increase levels of care. We're going to increase supervision responses. We're going to increase social services. What ultimately occurred is we got more positives from certain people, but we got a lot more honesty. Mm-hmm. People felt like they could walk into the session and say, I used, let me explain what happened. This weekend, this happened. So-and-so came over, the game was on. Something tragic happened with a family member. I learned this at work. And then they would start telling us all about it and why they used, and counseling was present, and they're taking notes like crazy, or saying, thank you for being honest. We're not going to sanction this use. We are going to direct all of this to counseling. And yes, we have to have patience because our people take longer to be able to obtain abstinence for court purposes.
Right.
But once they start putting those strategies in place and get it, we get real buy-in. I'll tell you one story. I do a lot of, we call them peer reviews here in Georgia, where we go and visit other teams. And the benefit of doing a peer review is you get to interview anonymously their participants.
Oh, interesting.
And so I can go into a room of 10 or 12 participants, and they know that they have confidentiality and can talk about the program. And when you go to a program that hasn't made this shift, the discussions that I hear are all fear-based. They want to talk about when they were punished inappropriately, or what they have to do to make sure they don't get caught, or what they have to do to not go to jail. And there's a lot of anxiety, and the focus is on how do I not go to jail, or how do I not get punished? But if you go to a program that understands this, the conversations are about, I am so fortunate. This team is providing me what I need. I have trust. I have confidence. I can be honest with them. I'm really healing. And it's a completely different discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so tangible.
That's fascinating. And what jumps out at me with the previous example you gave is, you know, you have this individual who, where abstinence is still a distal goal. And so there's a resumed use incident, but there's this proximal goal of honesty, and they come in and they're honest about it. So where you have a situation where previously we may have viewed as a situation where a sanction's in order, there's actually an incentive potentially involved because they came in and they demonstrated that they could be honest, which is one of the goals previously set. And so it's just such an interesting way to think about sort of the way incentives and sanctions get utilized. And I think we should talk about incentives and sanctions through this lens. But I want to highlight something you and I have talked a little bit about, and that is a difference between the first edition of this standard and this current second edition, which is that idea of the matrix. And so everything we've talked about in relation to the second edition of the standards, you know, I talked about those themes throughout. Trust is one of them. Another one is obviously that sort of individualized approach, that we're making decisions collaboratively with people based on the very specific circumstances of their lives, and talking to treatment and talking to supervision and putting that all together. You know, that previously there was the idea that, you know, you would have a matrix and you could just sort of match behavior to a sanction or an incentive, and the work is done for you because it's all printed on a piece of paper. We're moving away from that in this standard. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why and really what that should look like, rather than a sort of cookie cutter matrix approach.
I love that question, because as I go out and I meet with teams, every team generally tells me, can you help us? We want to improve our matrix. And they use that term matrix as if it is as simple as if you come up with every potential possibility and you put it in this magical formula that you will come out with the perfect answer. And that's why what you mentioned, that if they do a search of the entire document here, they won't find the word matrix. And that's why there's not some magical matrix that All Rise sends out to every team and says, if you just do this, because if it were as simple as using a matrix, we wouldn't need all the professionals sitting around the table every single week making these decisions. And so what we do is what you're talking about, is that when we have a behavior that we need to respond to, we first try to figure out who is the person and what is the behavior. In our team, we start directly with treatment. We find out right from the beginning, from treatment, where is the person, what is going on, you know, what type of what kind of response do we need from treatment? Is this in alignment with what where we expect them to be? Is their current treatment plan covering them? And then I move over to supervision. Those are generally my first two looks at the team and find out from supervision if they believe that the modalities we're using to supervise meet that. And it really is individualized. And then my case manager is ready to jump in on a minute's notice if she believes that one of those other components is not being met, or peer support may jump in and say, this is something. And so we really are doing it on a person by person basis. We have our general responses. We have enough people and we have enough of the similar situations that a lot of our responses are going to be the same, but we never want to take it for granted that it's the same. We want to make sure that we have identified for this particular person that general response is right, or change it when it needs to be changed.
Thank you so much for clarifying that. And I should note, All Rise has a great resource that we came out with this summer, right around the time of the RISE conference. It'll be in the episode notes, and I really encourage people to look that up, because it's not a matrix, but it does help guide them in terms of kind of which incentives and which sanctions and when. And I'll make sure that's in the episode notes. Let's talk about incentives for a second, because you said something really interesting to me about incentives. A way you approach it in your court that really aligns with the standards. How should we be thinking about incentives for treatment court participants, and what is the ultimate purpose of those incentives when we give them?
First and foremost, we want to reinforce good behaviors. Mm-hmm. And when people meet goals. So we obviously, that's number one, we want to reinforce that. And also, we want to be able to show those off to our other participants who are vicariously learning from each other. And so when someone obtains something, they can learn that. We also want to motivate them to try to attain that. And when we go around and I meet with other teams, one of the things that teams always want to know is, how do I do more incentives? I think teams understand that the more incentives we can provide, the better results we're going to get. And they want to come up with some great incentive structure. And I think great incentive structures, complicated ones, wonderful ones, are excellent. But I tell teams, let's start with keeping it simple first. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much we can do that is free and simple that you don't have to worry about all of this other if you can do that. And so I'm going to just focus on three P's. The first P, as we know, is just praise. The population that we serve, they don't get a lot of praise. They don't get a lot of positive reinforcement. They don't get a lot of people saying, you did this right. You are of value. Second is, we want to give them public recognition. We want to recognize them in front of the other participants for a job well done, or for something, a decision that they've made. And so not only does that reinforce to others what they're doing, but it also increases their self-worth that, hey, people are seeing that I'm doing the right thing. And then the third P I want to talk about, and of course, this is all free.
Yeah.
Third P I want to talk about is giving back participants their time. So participant time. And to me, that is something that is free to our courts that we can always do, whether it's being able to leave a status conference early, whether it's being able to, you know, get some time back somewhere else. But to me, time is one of those commodities that there's a limited quantity of, and our participants are stretched thin. So providing them back, whether it's through a community service credit, those three things are free, and you can use plenty of them in addition to any other incentives you have.
Thank you for that. I love that idea of time, of giving them time. And it's something we all can use more of, but also that the court has a lot of control over when it comes to an individual. You're listening to Standards of Justice, and we want to hear from you. Drop us a line at allrise.org/pod. And if you like what you hear, help expose more people to the show by leaving a review or a 5-star rating on whatever platform you get your podcasts. Okay, let's get back to it. Let's switch gears to sanctions. Sanctions is where we can potentially cause some real harm. And so what is the standard really tell us about the use of sanctions and how sanctions should be applied?
Well, first, you and I understand that sanctions are punishment. Mm-hmm. They're meant to deter. They're meant to be a negative consequence that we don't want. And so sanctions don't teach our clients any skills. They just teach our clients what not to do. And our clients may already know what not to do. Maybe they don't. But that's the value of a sanction. It's probably one of the least effective tools we have besides doing nothing at all. But we do have to respond with sanctions when we do have conduct. And our team kind of looks at it. Is the conduct a symptom of the disease, or is it willful and intentional? And that's kind of that proximal distal. And so when we have willful conduct, that's when we do need to respond to say, this is conduct that we don't want to see again, or we want to remove. And so, you know, I always start with sanctions is first identifying. We always want to identify to the participant what that conduct is so that they are clearly aware. And I need to make sure I'm always doing it calm. Of course, we know we don't want to use any shaming or stigmatizing language. And as I highlight that behavior, I also want to point out the positives in the sequence of events. And sometimes that we may not think to do that, but so you didn't show up for group, but you did call your probation officer right away, and you've already rescheduled your next appointment. So we want to not only point out the negative, but also highlight all the good things in there so they don't hear just the negative. We want to make sure that we give them an opportunity to explain. And then we want to explain to them why that conduct is not acceptable and why we want different conduct in the future. And then we tell them why we've chosen the particular response. And so that they have an understanding from the beginning of what it is. They've had a chance to be heard. We do it calmly. We do it respectfully. And we explain why we're putting that particular response so they understand. And then the last thing I always do, and I think this is the benefit of treatment courts, is we always express hope and confidence that the person will be able to do better in the future. And we always end with that really positive note.
How much are the participants aware, either going into the program or kind of as they move through the program, of sort of here's the type of sanction we may deliver, and here's when you might expect it to happen? I mean, do you have those conversations with participants kind of early on so that they know it won't be a surprise necessarily should a sanction come their way? How much do you talk about that with participants?
The way that we handle it is that, first of all, we make sure that they understand the expectations. Of course, they're in their contract and the handbook, and that's our whole first phase, is explaining in the expectations. Then in our handbook, we also include what the levels of responses are. And we don't have a matrix in the handbook, but we do have that the guidelines of the levels of responses. And we can say this is what participants may expect if they do have a violation. So I don't have a lot of conversations with participants about it. It's just part of our educational materials. But when we get into the courtroom and someone has made a mistake, what we do try to do is allow that person to explain the mistake if it's not in a shaming or embarrassing way, to the other participants. And so hopefully they can learn, and then they can provide the lesson they've learned to the other participants. So we bring it back that way. Mm-hmm. But as far as telling them specifically what you're facing, we kind of leave that up to our educational materials.
Well, it's a good reminder too, as treatment courts are digging into the standards, having conversations about changes to the program, that, you know, participant handbooks, policy and procedure manuals, phase structures, all of these need to undergo some revision when decisions are made about kind of changing course in the way treatment courts operate. And I only mention that because we get that question a lot too. And sometimes that comes last, where the courts sort of evolved in their thinking and maybe even some of their practices, but it's got to be memorialized in those materials, particularly materials that participants receive, so that it's reflective of the latest thinking. Let's talk about jail. This comes up pretty regularly on this show, and emphatically in my last conversation about Standard 5 and Standard 6. The standards could not be more clear about a couple of things related to the use of jail. One, in which jail is not treatment. And should never be used as such. specific to this standard, what does the standard tell us about the use of jail?
It's very clear that we have to be very thoughtful and understand jail before we would ever use it. And one of the problems that jail has is if it's just a response to behavior, as you've already mentioned, it's not treatment. But it also reconnects people with a lot of non-prosocial people. People that are in jail are not the people we want our folks hanging out with. And it also disconnects our people from the pro-social pieces that they have, their employment, their counseling, their family, any other supports they have in the community. So it actually does the exact opposite of what we're trying to accomplish. But beyond that, here's I'm going to go back to that trust. Mm-hmm. If I'm expecting my participants to come into my courtroom and be honest with me, and that we're developing a team therapeutic alliance. I mean, I'm not developing a personal therapeutic alliance with, but my clinicians are, my other treatment people are developing. How can I come in and a person is having a problem and my response is, well, I respect you as a person. I see you as a human being, but for a little while, I'm going to take away everything you have, take away all of your freedom, and I'm going to put you out in one of the places you desire to go the least. Mm-hmm. And how can I expect that participant is going to have the same trusting relationship with me or my team? And so while I may not be able to create therapeutic alliance that's happening with the professionals, I can absolutely destroy it because our clinicians are part of our team and is seen as part of our team. And so to me, using jail potentially destroys that. Now, sometimes we have to use it. So if it is a public safety issue, to mm-hmm. me, that is the time that we should be looking at jail. Is there an imminent public safety risk? And I know there's other reasons that are put out there by people that they want to try to, if a person is in active use and they're trying to hold them for a bed, well, jails aren't treatment and they're not designed for that. We need to look at every other possible least restrictive avenue we have, from crisis stabilization units to daily check-ins to immediate medication assisted treatment, anything that we can do to avoid jail, and only use jail when it's really needed to protect the public.
That's really well said. And I should add, the standards aren't just clear on when not to use jail and those situations when jail should be used. What's beautiful about the standards is, and what this standard is all about, is instead of, for those courts that maybe have in the past over-relied on jail, there's guidance in here that if applied, achieves what you think you were achieving by sending that individual to jail. So it's not just saying you don't do that and leaving it at that. It's the more we can start to implement the standard and the way it's outlined in the standard, the ultimate goal hasn't changed. What the change we want to see in the individual, the sustained recovery, the engagement with their community and with their family, you know, those goals are universal. We're offering in this standard a much more evidence-based and I would say kind of compassionate way to get about that goal that doesn't potentially jeopardize their health, their safety, their recovery, their trust in the program.
You've hit something very important. And to me, this is when you talk about evolution, we have a collaboration. You talked about those two terms. This is where those two are perfectly aligned. Mm-hmm. Around this table, our team table, we have professionals from all the important disciplines. And they all have gotten degrees or their experience in this area. And so to me, the evolution is, let's not use this strategy or decision that does all the things that ruin what we're doing. But we have enough smart people in this room that we can come up with a different strategy, something that will also send the correct message. We don't have to mis-message anything. We don't say we're agreeing with what you're doing or what you're doing is permitted. What we're saying is it is not. Here is our response, and we're going to continue to utilize non-jail responses. And we have enough people with supervision, treatment, peer support, mm-hmm. case management that we can keep that person busy and tighten down all the screws without taking that ultimate last step.
Yeah.
And if we are as good as we say we are, and I may not be as good as I say, but the people around me are, we can come up with a better strategy.
The standard goes into some detail about prescription medication, and I think this is an important issue to highlight real quick here. Because I think this is one that I think can sometimes get confused. What do we need to know about prescription medication and how it relates to court policy and particularly responding to individual behavior?
I think the most important thing is that we don't want to get between a client and their doctor.
Yeah.
I'm not a doctor. I think we've seen some of those cases coming down against different states and different courts where court tried to substitute their judgment for medical judgment. So it's not my job to substitute my judgment, but it is our team's job to make sure that any medical provider is making an informed decision. Hmm. So it's our responsibility to have an open line of communication with any prescriber to make sure they understand any type of diagnosis they have, any behaviors we're seeing, and make sure that they're what's being prescribed to them is in alignment with the goals that we're trying to achieve. But I'm not going to try to override any medical prescription that is in alignment with the goals that we're trying to achieve.
I think that's a really important point. And as I said, one that continues to come up in conversations with teams. There's obviously an entire standard on the role of the judge. I'd love to hear from you as a judge. What does it look like when your team is sitting around the table and sort of navigating some of these difficult decisions around behavior? And we've talked about, making sure that not a lot of it's pre-programmed, but I imagine that even with all the guidance that's included in this standard, and even with a fair amount of common understanding about the principles of incentive sections and service adjustments, that there is still times when the team is sitting across from each other and not necessarily aligned on what to do. And I ask this because this is another one that we hear from all the time from folks. It's like, yeah, you say this in the standards, great. But when push comes to shove and we're sitting in that room, it becomes really difficult to follow through with a lot of what the standards are saying, or particularly in the face of maybe resistance at the other side of the table. What does that look like in your courtroom? And how do you help the team sort of come to some common decisions around behavior?
I think first, as the judge or coordinator, we have to make sure it's a safe place.
Yeah.
That people feel confident that they can give their professional opinion. When we talked about evolution, I think that is one of the evolutions of these courts, is that treatment feels more comfortable saying their position and not feeling like they have to box it into what the probationer judge is expecting. So number one is I don't speak at all at the beginning. Mm. I want to give them the opportunity to speak, because if I start saying what I think, it is going to shade what everyone starts saying potentially. So I've got to make sure it's safe. I think the team has to have trust in each other. And if they don't have trust in each other, we're going to then fall into where they're not listening to what the other side is saying. And instead of trying to come to a collaborative response, it's going to be oppositional.
Yeah.
So I make sure we listen to all. And sometimes if someone is not speaking up, I will specifically look out to them and get their opinion. And then I just do the best at the end. Most of the time, we come to a collaborative response. Fortunately, our team does have that confidence and safety. And if treatment says, well, here's my recommendation, and supervision says, I hear you, but here's the public safety behavior we're seeing, and we're going to have to do something a little different because of this. Treatment understands that piece, and public safety understands. Yeah. But if it's ever at that point, then I will just say, well, I'm going to do this. I'm explaining why I'm choosing this. Every point is valid, but here's the reason why I'm choosing this. And I've got to be very clear to explain, I've heard everyone, but this is why I'm choosing this. And, being as a judge, a lot of people don't understand all of the different things we're taking into account.
Yep.
And we take into account things that maybe none of the other people are taking into account, like the perception of our program and making sure that everything appears to be fair. And there's other things that we're doing that I've got to articulate sometimes just so they take that into account. And when you get to that point, then these discussions, while they're not easy decision, become easy to have.
That's really helpful. And that idea of trust, you know, it swings both ways. It's trust with the participant, but that idea that the team is grounded in a sense of trust and respect for each other is so key. As we start to wrap up, I want to touch on one thing that is a part of this standard and some others. It should be very hard to get removed from treatment court. I think most people are aligned in that. And I think particularly of, you know, look, Judge Netto walked us through the target population we are serving here, high risk, high need. So there should be no misunderstanding about the challenge that's going to be involved with serving that population, right? And a lot of what the standards do is help prepare us for kind of what we're going to see with those folks. So it should be really hard to get removed from treatment court. You know, what do the standards say about this specifically? And I'm curious if this has come up in your program or in programs you've gone out and trained where folks are like, yeah, again, you can say that in paper in the standards and print it off and that's great. But when we're sitting there in the room, it can feel very different. What do the standards say about handling discharge? And then I'm curious how you handle that.
Standards do a great job. I mean, they just make it really clear that we should not be removing anyone unless a couple of conditions or one of a few conditions are out there. First, the participant, if they're posing an immediate risk to public or community safety, and we're not able to manage that, such as if I have someone who just doesn't stop driving and they're potentially impaired and we can't address any of that, and they're putting the public at risk, and we don't have a way to make that prevent that risk, then we might have to remove them. Sometimes participants just choose to voluntarily withdraw. Now, that doesn't mean we should make our best efforts to try to convince them otherwise. The woman I spoke about earlier who told us that she was ready to be done, I mean, she told me she had, the one thing I didn't mention, she had told me she had told her four children goodbye and that she'd be back in a couple of months, and she was going to go to jail that morning.
Oh, yeah.
And we dissuaded her.
Yeah. Yeah.
I said, I'm not going to do that today. And our team said, we're not going to let you do this today. And so we were able to successfully dissuade her. I can't dissuade everyone, but we were able to dissuade. And then we have the participants that just, no matter what treatment modality, they're not willing to participate. But that doesn't mean just because they don't participate in the first one that we give up. We've got to be able to listen to them, find out what isn't working. Do they have an alignment with their counselor? Do we need to look at a different modality, a different provider? So it's not just as simple as they're not engaging, but it has to be something where we've really given our best efforts to meet that participant. And one thing I sometimes hear when I go around, you've probably heard this, is, hey, we're doing more work than the participant.
Yeah. Yep.
And that is true. And that should be true for some of our participants until they're able to do the work themselves. And so to me, that is not a disqualifier, that we feel like we're putting in more effort. As long as the person is showing up and giving some effort and there's hope that they're going to progress, we do need to start out doing more of the work. And that should never be a slight. Those are the people we're bringing into the program. So we very rarely will let someone leave the program, even if they tell us they want to leave. We basically try to dissuade, change treatment, unless they're just really a public safety risk or give up completely.
Thank you for that. That's a very clear explanation. And you're right. The standards are really specific here, and they have a lot of guidance here. And you know, one of the limitations of the show is we can't get to every element of the standards. As always, we encourage folks to go in, read the standards. You know, there's a lot about supervision. There's a lot about phases in the standard. And I think when you start to view particularly something like phases through the lens of proximal and distal, it may lead to some shifting around of how courts are approaching that. So just to reiterate to folks, get in there and open them up and read them. and reach out if you have questions. And, you know, All Rise is so strengthened by the fact that we have faculty of all disciplines all over the country, like Judge Auslander, who are generally available, should we ask, to help folks understand these standards and any other issues. So, Judge, I really appreciate you spending some time with us digging into this.
Thanks.
Okay, that was Judge Charles Auslander on Standard 4, Incentive Sanctions and Service Adjustments. I just loved that conversation. I thought he did a really excellent job of taking some of the trickier elements of the standard and putting them in a really accessible way. So I hope you agree with me and enjoyed the show. I mentioned, and as always, we will have a bunch of resources put in the episode notes, including the Incentive Sanctions and Service Adjustments publication from All Rise and some others, online training, in-person training, some webinars that are archived. There's a lot of stuff on this topic to dig into, and I'll try to put as much of it at your fingertips as I can. And I, you know, as we approach the midway point of this podcast, I just want to thank everyone who's been tuning in. I've been getting some really insightful feedback. Please keep sending it our way, allrise.org/pod. I read everything that comes in, and I just appreciate, and I'm not surprised by, but I do appreciate that Treatment Court folks are listening and are taking this stuff to heart and really doing what they can to better understand these standards, because the better we understand these standards, the more lives we can save, and we all know that's what it's all about. So thank you for that, and as always, stay safe out there.